You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rowan Conway. I am the Director of Research and Innovation here at the RSA. It's my very great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Adrian Wooldridge. Adrian is the Economist Management Editor and writes the Garlanded Schumpeter column. He was previously based in Washington and was Washington Bureau Chief, and is author of a number of books, quite a substantial number of books, on business economics and conservatism. Adrian's joining us today to talk about major 21st century disruptions, both at a macro scale but also at the scale of work, so at a very human scale, in the worlds of economics and work. This is of particular interest to us here at the RSA at the moment, because we're looking at what a good human-centred economy that can unlock creativity and enable a more sustainable, inclusive and dynamic economic structure might look like. So, Adrian, we're delighted you've been able to join us today to share some of your expert insights. And so without further ado, let's get straight to it and welcome Adrian Wooldridge.
Thank you so much. And I love the word garlanded. I shall use that in the future. In 2009, I came back from having spent many years in the United States. I managed to persuade The Economist that it was time to introduce a business column. And we had to think of a name for the business column, because at The Economist we don't have bylines, but we do have dead people's bylines, or bylines borrowed from places or from dead people. So we have Charlemagne for Europe, we have Badgett for Britain, and we have Lexington for the United States. So we're trying to think of a name for a business column. And we thought, for a long time back, calling it Wilson, after James Wilson, who was the founder of The Economist, who was a businessman, an entrepreneur, a rather great man in many ways, and funded Badgett's enterprise. But then we thought the name Wilson doesn't really work. You think of Harold Wilson here, you think of President Wilson in the United States, it just doesn't get the blood flowing. So we thought for a long time couldn't really find a name. And then eventually, thankfully, we thought of the name Schumpeter. And no sooner did the name Schumpeter come out of the mouth of the great inventor of that term, me, but we all agreed on the fact that it would work, basically because I think the notion that we live in an age of creative destruction, of disruption, Schumpeter talks about the great gales of creative disruption blowing through the economy, seemed exactly right. We seem to be moving from the age of Keynes to the age of Schumpeter, from the age of managed capitalism to the age of the entrepreneur, and so we immediately thought we would call the column that. And I think that was an exactly right decision, that we have seen over the last few years a succession of huge disruptions in the economy. So many disruptions, really, that I think it's reasonable to say that we actually live in an age of disruption, much more than we've seen for a long period of time. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what's driving those disruptions, what they mean for management, and how we can actually live with this period of sustained disruption. I think quite clearly they're being driven by technology. The pace of technological change has become faster and more, and the impact of that technological change has become more pervasive than anything that we've seen before. Schumpeter himself said that the great function of capitalism was to take the silk stockings that Elizabeth I wore and turn them into something that any shop girl could afford. That took three centuries. Now we see the mobile phone having gone from something that was an exotic thing that very, very few people used in the mid-1990s to something that most people on Earth, including many, many poor people, use. So the pace of technological dissemination is incredibly fast at the moment. I think the television took from invention to common usage about 70 years, electricity took about 50 years, the internet took less than 10 years. And the internet is also, at the same time, mutating at an extraordinary speed. Having been just something that you looked at for information, it's become social, it's become all-pervasive, and it's become mobile. So the pace of technological change is absolutely extraordinary. Similarly, the pace of capital flow is extraordinary and extraordinarily disruptive. You see something rather arcane in the housing market, swaps and things like that, becoming something that actually subverts the whole stability of the global capitalist economy in 2007, 2008. Then we have globalization, again, a force which is changing the world very, very quickly, and which I think is actually much closer to the beginning than to the end of globalization. I think we're much closer to the beginning than the end of globalization. I think about 20% of traffic on the internet crosses borders, about 5% of investment capital crosses borders at the moment. We have a very, very long way to go with globalization. So the forces of disruption, I think, are going to get worse and worse, or better, whatever your perspective is. And I think they're also going to become much more pervasive. We have this notion, I think rightly so, that at the moment software eats everything. Software has been at the heart of technological change recently. We've had Moore's Law, which dictates the speed of the amount of information you can pack onto a silicon disk doubles every 18 months. That law, that extraordinary pace of change, is spreading throughout the economy. It's affecting, let's say, the car industry. It's affecting other forms of manufacturing through 3D printing. We're having software spreading everywhere and changing the logic of economic development and the pace of change. So Bill Gates once said that if we'd seen the amount of progress in the car industry that we've seen in the computer industry, the average car would now cost about $25. Now, we're probably not going to see that, but I think what we are going to see is a sustained fall in the basic price of what you can get in your car, and very radical changes in the way that you relate to your car, for example, of course, with the eventual rise of self-driving cars. So three big disruptions which all reinforce each other, and disruptions which are changing the very nature of the companies that we work for and the way that management of those companies operates. So basically what we see now at the moment is a huge premium on companies that are asset light and people light. So if you go back to 1900, the biggest company in the world, US Steel, employed 750,000 people. It employed more people than the US Navy and Army combined. If you look at the sort of companies that are today driving the global economy, they employ very, very few people. I think Google is a giant, really. It employs 50,000 people. Facebook probably employs 8,000 people. Twitter, about 3,000 people. So very, very small numbers of people. Big hedge funds, I call them big hedge funds in terms of the amount of money they control, but the number of people they employ is very, very small. These are incredibly flexible institutions. They can change very quickly. You look at the way that Facebook adapted to the mobile revolution, look at the way Netflix cannibalized itself to be a streaming company. So the emphasis is always on being people light, asset light, very, very, very quick to change. And it's very difficult to see how that is likely to change in the near future. So these central institutions in our lives changing. The central drive is to have as little commitment to people or place as you possibly can. I think the really interesting trend that is going on in this world now is the world of Uber, is the world of contract-based companies, which essentially are ways of arranging transactions between me, a person with a car, and an opportunity. Essentially, companies are just becoming intermediaries. They're disappearing entirely. They're becoming facilitators of transactions. So you get a spot market in talent, a spot market in opportunities, and no real organization, the virtualization of all organizations, and a constant pressure for that to be the basic model whereby the world is organized. And you're seeing this all the way, not just in cars, but not just in taxi services, but in professional services, in food delivery, in all sorts of areas of the economy. I think in many ways that will become the employment model of the future. We're also seeing, and I think it's something that affects the middle classes more than anything else, which is really the end of guilds. The middle classes have tended in the past to be rather successful at shielding themselves against Schumpeter's four scales of creative disruption by creating guilds, which were very well managed, which you did a lot of work, perhaps for pretty low pay when you were young, but you got some security of tenure and you stayed within these guilds for the rest of your life. Those guilds are being ripped apart, starting with consultancies. which are increasingly getting rid of the partnership model, increasingly being driven in a much more competitive way. Looking at universities, another area here where you have a much smaller declining group of people with tenure and basically a large number of sort of information serfs who work for the professors at the top of the system. So a hollowing out of those guilds. And I think also the public sector, which is traditionally a very well-protected guild, is beginning to change, is changing actually quite rapidly. I think under Cameron, the number of permanent civil servants has declined by 17%. There's an increasing sense that what the public sector is a platform which provides services to people, plugs into NGOs, plugs into the private sector, plugs into all sorts of other service providers, ceases to be something that's exclusive and provides lifelong employment, and becomes, in a sense, something defined by the service that it provides. And also, I think that technology is massively changing two of the most important parts of this guild. One is education. Increasingly, education is going to be something provided over the internet, provided over the tablet, much less by personal contact, and indeed medical provision. Increasingly, particularly for congenital problems, people will be monitored by remote control, monitored over the Internet of Things, and will not have the sort of constant contact with doctors that they did in the past. So this big guild that's been at the very centre of our welfare society is being reinvented at the moment. So I think if I want to stand back and look at what this great disruption means, this technology-driven, capital markets-driven disruption means, I think the best way to do that is to look at the world from 1945 onwards, look at that world and look at what's happening, what's different about that world now. And I think that world was defined by managerial capitalism, which was put in place after the Great Depression, by really an alliance between big government, big trade unions, and big companies, big industry. It was defined by a Western-focused sort of capitalism. It was focused on the United States primarily, but also on Europe, as Europe reconstructed itself after the Second World War. And it was defined by a sort of control, a sort of way of organizing society, which focused most importantly on long-term stability, on a long-term future. And all of that sort of capitalism is being destroyed at the moment. We're seeing a big shift from managerial capitalism to entrepreneurial-based capitalism, the idea that companies can be created from nothing and can become dominant companies very, very quickly. We're seeing a shift away from the dominance of the United States and Europe towards the very rapid rise of emerging markets, particularly Asia, but emerging markets everywhere. And we're seeing, above all, and I think this is particularly important at the moment, what's going on, is the collapse of the Keynesian consensus, the old social democratic consensus. As I said, we used to be in the age of Keynes. We're now moving towards the age of Schumpeter. We also used to be in the age of consensus politics, governed by these big institutions, big labor, big capital, and focused on stability. And now we're moving towards a world which is much more volatile than that. We're seeing much greater volatility in politics, with the rise of anti-political parties, the rise of minority political parties. We're seeing much more scepticism about big politics, about long-established machine politics. I think we, in Britain, the Conservative Party used to have, in Britain, 20% of people, adults, were basically members of political parties. It's now about 1%. The Conservative Party, I think, has gone from 3 million members to now about 130,000 members. So a collapse in these big institutions, a collapse of faith in politics as a solution to people's problems, and a rise in volatility. All of this taking place against the background of a shift in wealth and power towards the emerging world, and a rise of entrepreneurial as against managerial capitalism, which creates a very, very volatile background, I think, to the world. So that's what's happened. That's the result of disruption. And I think many people, particularly the winners from this process, have been very blasé about what it means. You have if you go to San Francisco, you know, you have all this tech crunch stuff. You have something called Disrupt San Francisco. You have the endless celebration of disruption. I think it's right to celebrate the potential and the power of technology, but disruption is also rather disturbing. I met somebody in San Francisco who said that he'd worked for a disruptive organization, but that disruptive organization had been put out of business by another disruptive organization. So he was thinking of a disruptive business model to disrupt the disruptor. And I think, well, that's all right if you've got a trust fund and if you've got a fairly stable life. But what's happening in society at the moment, I think, is much more difficult than that. It's quite all right to move house, to move to another part of the world, to move to a new job, if you're moving to a job with better pay, a house with more rooms, a nicer environment. But what's happening to large numbers of people in the world at the moment is they're having to disrupt themselves for less pay or the same pay, the same circumstances. They're moving house, they're moving jobs, and they're not doing any better. And I think this general sense of churn and change, but for no great benefit, is creating some big problems. So this disruptive revolution that we've seen is unleashing some demons which were controlled during the great age of managerial capitalism. It's unleashing the demon of inequality, massive, massive growth in inequality, as so much of the benefits of disruption is captured by a tiny proportion of people. It's unleashing the demon of the disposable worker, I think. The average time that a worker will stay in a job in the retail sector, which is the biggest employment sector in the United States, is 3 years now. The number of people who had permanent jobs in that sector, as opposed to temporary jobs, has gone from 70% to 30%. So the disposable worker, and I think it's leading to the rise of identity politics, both in the worst sort of ISIS sort of sense, but also pervasively in the UKIP sense, in the Scottish nationalist sense, in the Basque sense. People are clinging, as their society, as their world is disrupted, they cling to things that give them a sense of identity. So I think we should be very careful about being blasé about this disruptive world. It's a very dangerous world in some ways. What do we do about it? I'm just very briefly going to talk about what we do about it. I think the worst thing that we can do about it is to try and stop it, because what you will do, essentially, is to cut off any of the benefits without actually stopping it, because it'll find ways of coming in through the back door if it doesn't come in through the front door. There are many people who talk about inclusive capitalism, about conscious-driven capitalism as a way of improving things. I'm very sceptical about that, again, personally, because I think that quite often it's an excuse for big incumbent companies to protect themselves against competition. And quite often, the more that you qualify capitalism in these senses, the more you create inclusive or socially responsible capitalism, the more you make it more difficult to create jobs, and it's the creation of jobs that I think is particularly vital at this moment. Another more respectable argument is education. All we need to do is educate people more. This is the sort of mantra of quite a lot of liberal capitalists: just put more money in education and you will solve all of these problems, because, you know, if society is going to churn, you have to prepare people for the churn. Again, I think that can easily be overplayed. I don't think it's the cure-all that it used to be thought to be. And I think many of these disruptions are actually going to hit educated workers as much as they have in the past hit manual workers. We're seeing big areas of the professions, big areas of the educated classes being affected by this. So I would say that it's very, very hard to deal with, but I would point to two things that we need to do. One is that a lot of these disruptive technologies are also opportunities for dealing with many of the worst problems that we experience. If you think of our living standards, our collective living standards, the thing that really have held us back, have stagnated wages, have been healthcare costs, education costs, government costs and taxes, human services costs. And I think we are beginning to see, because of new technology, a real possibility of controlling the costs of human services, delivering education well but cheaply, delivering healthcare, or at least controlling the rising costs of healthcare. So we're beginning to get the sort of productivity improvements that we had in the manufacturing sector, in the information sector. And I think also when it comes to equality, we can, through the internet, through tablets and the rest of it, provide an extraordinary amount of educational and opportunity to poorer people, particularly in the emerging world, that it's getting cheaper to put people in contact with the best minds and the best teachers in the world. I think that Bill Gates himself gets his children to learn to go over their home on the Khan Academy. That's free. That's on the internet. The richest man in the world and everybody else can use the same technology, basically, to catch everything. So there is a very bright side to this technology which we need to use and exploit. And finally, I think that one thing that we need to look at more and more, I'm more and more convinced about this, is different forms of ownership, different forms of capitalism. We've become fixated, particularly in this country, on public companies, on shares which are constantly traded, on broadly held companies. And I think different sorts of ownership, which have a longer-term perspective, can act as a sort of moderating influence on this sort of hyper-capitalism we have at the moment. I would point to the role of family companies, which have a long-term view of the future and some sort of commitment to durability. I'd also point to different models of ownership, cooperative ownership, the John Lewis model, various other sorts of models of partnership, again, which can be a sort of counteraction to this hyperactivity of capitalism. But I would hasten to say that I don't think there are any very simple solutions to this problem. I think this is going to be a disruptive period that we're going through, and it's going to be a disruptive period that will fatally affect the sort of comfortable guild-dwelling sections of society who've traditionally been protected from this. You know, the educated middle classes, and a radicalized educated middle class is one of the most disruptive forces in the world. So the great problem with disruption, I think, at the moment, is that we will actually have a huge backlash against capitalism unless we can do something to moderate and control and constrain some of those forces which have been unleashed by the man under whose name I write, Mr. Schumpeter. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Lots of food for thought there. I'm interested in a number of different elements in your book. The book's very interesting in that it scales multiple things, going right from that macroeconomic picture of what disruption is looking like across the globe, right down to what does this look like at a worker level? How do people behave day to day? And I think there's a lot of unknowns within that. I think that concept of unknown is something that is really, really prescient for me here. So you talk a lot about volatility here, but it's still often said, the mantra is that markets don't like uncertainty. You know, you've just taken us through three big disruptive trends with a litany of uncertainty. What will be the change, the terms of the debate around this, specifically with, you know, that issue of markets don't like uncertainty? How will they learn to cope?
With difficulty, I think. I think we're going to. What we've had is since the financial crisis, we've had a reasonably stable macroeconomic environment as we've absorbed this shock. And I think we're going to move away from that because we have a huge uncertainty with China, where growth is slowing very significantly. And we have Greece. And I think the notion, there is a popular notion, I think, out there that we can absorb quite quickly Greece. Having a bigger crisis or having to leave the euro, and we've put in place enough safeguards that won't be a momentous problem. I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that it could be more of a shock to the euro, and the notion of the reversibility of the currency could have quite a big impact. So I think these two big uncertainties there of China plus the euro plus Greece is a big problem. And I would also add that I think the different pace of growth of Europe and United States again introduces volatility. So I think the disruption is continuing, but the macro environment is going to become more volatile. So I've got no good news here.
Okay. You're also very sceptical about this kind of conscious capitalism as a catch-all answer or something. But you did very clearly articulate that there's this sort of there's this space or a need to address humanity within this hollowed-out society that could be this dystopian future if disruption takes over. You know, what are your thoughts on alternative models, or what are some of the answers?
Well, I'm very sceptical about this idea that these conscious-driven capitalists can create a better world for us all, simply because they've decided that we need to slow things down or we need to improve things. And the reason I think that is because I think it's so often the case that it's incumbents in markets who will use regulations, who will use the idea of corporate social responsibility to protect themselves against innovators. And I think most of the, I think that's not a good thing. So if you imagine, let's say, universities being given more power to protect themselves against innovators in the knowledge industry, I don't think that's a good way of going. Because I think most of the big benefits of technology and the democratization of knowledge are going to come from new market entrants rather than people who are protecting this guild model. But I don't want to say that nothing can be done, because I think that would be blasé, actually. I think that they can do things, and what we need to do is look more at mechanisms rather than intentions. Just relying on the good intentions of people is not the right thing, and the mechanisms that we really need to think about most are ownership mechanisms. What we've done is created a system, particularly in Britain, whereby ownership is increasingly disappearing. It's increasingly fragmented. It's increasingly people don't own anything. And to the extent that they own shares, they own them for a second, a millisecond, for a very short period of time. So you've got this constant churn, these public companies, which are responsible essentially to no owners, or institutions which are constantly churning their ownership. So I think what we need to do is to try and have lots and lots of different models of ownership, because it's from different models of ownership that you can introduce different perspectives of time, different perspectives of responsibility. I've just written a long thing for The Economist about family companies, which are actually very weak in this country, very strong in a lot of the rest of the world. What family companies tend to do is they tend to be more stable in some ways. They tend to be much more long-term. They tend to think about the long-term future, because you're thinking about transmitting something to your children and your children's children, rather than public companies which think in terms of quarterly results and things like that. Also, cooperative ownership, the ownership, workers owning the means of production, the companies, again, I think is quite a powerful model. John Lewis has worked it very well. I'm not saying we should... What I am saying is I think we should have much more emphasis on a variety of ownership, which gives a different set of incentives in the economy. And Britain is very peculiar in this. The British like to think of themselves as a very pragmatic people, but actually when it comes to capitalism, they've been incredibly ideological. That in the United States, you have quite a pragmatic approach. You have dual shares. Lots of companies have dual shares. The New York Times has dual shares, for example. Walmart has dual shares. Many, many companies do that. We basically don't allow that. We don't allow it. We have very widely dispersed share ownership, single-class shares, which makes it very hard for families to exercise a role as stewards. It gives them a big incentive to get out of this stewardship role. And I think we should be less ideological about it, more willing to adapt different models of ownership. And again, I think that the dual share system works very well to preserve family ownership. It also works very well as an incentive for entrepreneurs to remain in companies. I mean, when Google went public, it went public with the dual-class ownership, the same as Facebook. All of these big tech companies are doing that, and the reason they give it is that if they give it just to these institutions who churn their shares all the time, they'll be forced to think in a very short-term way. And what Brendan Page said is, we are only willing to go public if we can preserve our ownership, so we can think in terms of 10, 20 years, so we can think in terms of driverless cars rather than just providing some good returns to the market. So Britain is Cartesian. It's ideological about capitalism. I think we need to be much more pragmatic and much more flexible and introduce a broad range of institutions with different incentives.
There are multiple ways of doing that, not a single system. No, many, I think you called it moving away from a sort of managed capitalism to more of an entrepreneurial age. Yeah. There was one thing I was particularly struck with. There's a kind of romantic tone in some of throughout your book. You know, the difference, the choice between Wilson and Schumpeter. And having before I got married, I was a Wilson, so I was rather...
Oh, were you?
I felt rather maligned by saying no one has ever been moved by a Wilson. That's okay. But but I moved on from that and continued to read. And within that, you do make the case, actually, for the study of art and taking the study of art more seriously if we're really going to sort of foster a culture of innovation in our companies. Can you elaborate a little bit more on
that? Yeah, I mean, I think that as capitalism moves towards a period in which brain power matters more than muscle, in which services matter more than just manufacturing, creativity moves to the centre. So the big question is, how do you train creativity? And I think the arts are the right thing to do. We need much more emphasis on the arts. And also, a lot of the stuff that I can't do, numbers, quantitative stuff, all that really difficult stuff, that can be done by machines, which is wonderful. So the more that that can all be contracted out to the robots and the machines, the more we have to look at things that are distinctive about the human ability. And the thing that really distinguishes human beings is creativity and artistic creativity. And a lot of what makes companies successful is their capacity to tell stories about the world. So some, you know, to conjure up interesting images or interesting narratives which act as a hook to us. And a lot of, you know, increasingly what we buy with our money is, you know, again, entertainment. And again, the arts are at the centre of this. So I think this notion, which is quite central to a lot of education policy around the world, that we need more STEM, we need more engineering, we need more science and the rest. But we do need those things, but quite often those are going to be the jobs that are going to be automated out of existence by robots, because robots are pretty clever at this sort of stuff. And it's the human, it's the specifically human thing that will be our selling point. So when we think that you know, the future will depend really on our interaction with technology, our capacity to interact with technology, our capacity to use technology as well as possible. So we have to think, where does our comparative advantage lie? And our comparative advantage doesn't lie in our ability to process large numbers of figures very, very quickly. Well, mine certainly doesn't.
I mean, it's quite exciting, the world beyond investment bankers. We will have an algorithm
for
that.
Well, it's quite interesting. If you look at the whole world of investment banking, I think it's particularly interesting. If you go back to the period from 1945 right the way to about 1960, these were not particularly glamorous people earning not particularly large amounts of money. It was a fairly routine sort of thing that lots of them were doing. And then we've become accustomed to the idea that it's the thing that everybody wants to do. It's the thing that if they want to make money, it's the thing that really pays very well. And I think we may well be moving towards a future in which it's much less of a money-making machine, or certainly for people. You know, robots can do it, but I think that, you know, talent will increasingly not be allocated to that area of the economy because of a combination of regulation and machines.
Sounds interesting. Questions from the audience.
Thanks. I was a bit puzzled by your characterization of conscious capitalists as people who just want to sort of put regulation and legislation in the way of would-be innovators and would-be disruptors and trying to slow things down. Whereas what I've seen, conscious capitalism thinks about, you know, there's got to be more to a company than just making money. That instead of always appealing to the financial stakeholders, there's a bigger, massive transformational purpose why this company exists. And you mentioned the famous letter by Brennan Page of Google. And as you pointed out, in part it was enabled by their dual share ownership thing system. But also, they said, we're not here just to make money. We are here to do great things in this world. And recently, Tim Cook of Apple said the same about the reasons for his company investing in a solar energy plant. He said, well, you know, this isn't done just for the narrow financial reason. It's done because it's the right thing to do. So isn't conscious capitalism a case of reasserting that there are other reasons to be in business beyond making money? The money thing is nice, but, you know, most great business leaders aren't there for that, and we just need to make sure that voice has a larger influence in the world.
My argument really is about the notion that we can improve capitalism just by benevolent people having good intentions. Which I think is not entirely unreasonable description of what some of this conscience or inclusive capitalism is. I think it's partly because you get perverse consequences of that, in the sense that I think it does tend to be something that appeals to incumbents who are in a powerful position already and are quite happy to see regulations imposed on the world, which makes it harder for new entrants to get into markets, which is why I use the example of a universities. Nowhere wonderful, high-minded institutions, but actually quite often acting in ways that protect insiders against outsiders. So I don't think it's enough to have good intentions, for people to have good intentions. That's why I think it's much more important to look at what people's actual incentives are, which is why I think ownership really matters. I think that if you have a system of ownership whereby people are essentially controlled by the institutions, it doesn't matter what their intentions are. They will do what the institutions, what the market dictates them to do. If you have an ownership structure whereby Brin and Page and various entrepreneurs have long-term control, then they can act according to their consciences or according to their, which I think is actually more important in the case of many of these entrepreneurs, in terms of their fanatical long-term vision for changing the world. I mean, you can think about people wanting to improve the world and make the world a nicer place. I think a lot of these entrepreneurs are not quite like that. What they have is a mania. They have a notion of solving a problem and focusing their resources on solving that problem. Let's say the problem of food. You know, why don't we grow our meats rather than have cows growing it? They focus on these problems. It's not because they're conscious driven. It's because they are people who become obsessed by things. So I'd like to see a world in which you have more, as I say, companies with powerful owners who can be driven by these visions. We have it with Amazon. It's not necessarily a sort of conscience thing. It's just that these are sort of slightly, am I allowed to say this? They're slightly crazy people. Entrepreneurs, people who start companies, are slightly crazy people. And in some ways, I think we ought to allow their craziness to last a bit longer than just IPOs.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed that. Can I ask, though, what might be a response to this? I wonder if there aren't certain continuities and persistences in this age of disruption that might also be worrying too. You mentioned the university sector, and I think in other sectors as well, you get an attempt to impose order through rankings, ideas of branding, of quality, of reputation, some sense of trying to enclose this disruption in a purposeful way through human intelligence and organizational activity. And I think with the universities, I'm very interesting, unlike computing and retailing, the dominant incumbents still stay around. They don't exit. If anything, they get stronger because quality and reputation and status and prestige are seen as very, very attractive to consumers in a very disorderly, chaotic informational age. And I wonder if, therefore, the age of disruption needs to be accompanied by some account of the continuities that we find and the persistences, if you like, the inequalities that might arise, and therefore the challenges for public policy around that, as well as the attempt simply to create innovation. How do we ensure that the new attempts at ordering this chaos aren't themselves another form of inequality?
I liked everything you said there. Formulating a response to it is rather difficult because it's a very intriguing set of things. But I think that you can have a lot of change within continuity. That a lot of these institutions, which look as though they were the same as they used to be, are changing very rapidly and actually internally are very different from what they used to be. So I think that the way that Harvard and Oxford and Cambridge stay at the top of this pile, and Stanford, is by constant revolution. That they're very different institutions from what they used to be. So although the status hierarchy can look the same, I think what you're getting for your money and your effort is quite often slightly different, but no, significantly different. I just wrote a piece for The Economist about British public schools, which, you know, since in 1945, when I was these schools were basically places that didn't teach women, didn't teach science, and put a huge amount of emphasis on sports. Now, they teach women extremely well, girls extremely well. They teach science extremely well. They're very academic, meritocratic institutions, so long as you can afford the fees. So a lot of what looks like stability can include a lot of change. However, I would say that the universities are still very guild-dominated institutions. And there is an enormous amount of change that is going on within the world of knowledge, ways of learning and ways of reaching people. I mean, I think Clay Christensen's argument about disruptive innovation, the great ideas coming from the bottom, coming from challengers and changing the world almost imperceptibly, but suddenly dethroning the incumbents. I don't think we will dethrone the incumbents, but I think we're going to dethrone something. We're going to create a very different world with the rise of cheap, technologically delivered education. So far, MOOCs haven't changed that much, but something will be different. I suspect that where the big difference will come will not be universities, which are quite good at packaging research and high-level teaching. It's going to come on the middle level, and it's going to come in the world of vocational education. Excellence we're good at. It's the middle-level vocational education that we're not good at. I think we're going to see massive changes in that world.
Hi. Yeah, you mentioned the shrinking of the public sector, and also we touched on conscious capital. Can you tell me a little bit more about the emergence of social enterprise? Will they be able to, in this disruptive age, connect to a wider marketplace?
Absolutely. I think that one of the extraordinary things that has happened in the world is that companies are basically born global, that you can become a global organization immediately. And I think that's incredibly good for profit-driven companies, but it's also incredibly good for social enterprises. Social enterprises can launch globally, they can act globally, they can think globally. And in fact, for them, it's actually sort of the comparative difference is probably greater because they can scale very quickly. And I think that I talk a lot in this book about the way in which that social enterprises have comparative advantage over profit-driven enterprise. Because one of the things you need to do in the modern economy is to motivate people, is to get people to work. And motivating people through values is one of the best ways of doing that. And quite paradoxically, actually, a lot now of private sector companies, profit-making companies, have realized that nobody worked that extra mile, you know, with the cry, we can boost the share price value to such and such. You do that because you're trying to solve various social problems. I think there's a lot of ersatz nonsense coming out of the private sector, but from the social sector, there's a lot of exceptionally good management coming from motivating people to solve problems. So I think the social sector is absolutely right at the centre of what's interesting about the world. I didn't talk enough about that, but I think if you look at the emerging world, you've got these extraordinary hybrid models as well of companies that are part profit making and part social, and use money from the profit side to the social side as well. So again, I think what we need is a sort of ecology with many, many more diverse institutions. So one of the things that I'd like to disrupt most is this notion of these dominant public companies, which are the only real form of capitalism, widely dispersed public companies. We need lots and lots of dispersed types of company and ownership.
It goes back to the point of diversity.
Yep, absolutely. Diversity, pluralism, all good things, I think.
Thank you. And I'll start my question with, do you think we'll tire of disruption? And the reason I ask is particularly around this issue of the pressure on middle-class lifestyles in this country and other countries as well, where people are starting to see what their predecessors, so to speak, have spent a lot of time working for, being pressurized. And do you think they'll somehow then try and rein in disruption just to have a more comfortable lifestyle? And I ask the question on the basis, I think probably disruption's a good thing, but I can actually see people actually just having enough of it and actually trying to make it not happen.
I'm tired of disruption. I'm too old for disruption. All these things are changing. My computer, I arrive and I've got to do things. I used to be able to turn it on. Now I have to put in a code, and then I have to get another code to put in the other code. And there's all this Twitter stuff. And it used to be great being a journalist. You commanded all this knowledge that other people didn't have. Now everybody's got hold of the knowledge. Everybody can distribute stuff. You're competing, you're competing with everybody. And everybody contains a lot of very clever people. So, yes, I am tired of disruption. I want to stop it. But I think it's very hard to do. It's sort of the pace of mutation, as we are talking about, the pace of mutation of the internet is quite extraordinary with the, you know, now the rise of the Twitter and the social media. And I can't see how you can stop it. As I say, if you try and stop it in the way that our cousins, the French, quite frequently do. If it doesn't come in through the front door, it comes in through the back door. And quite often, if you think you're stopping it, you're actually just giving another way in, and you won't get the benefits from it. And I think that quite often in many areas that the solutions to our biggest problems actually lie in the technology itself. I think our biggest problems with stagnating living standards come from the high relative costs of education, healthcare and human-related services, and I think that technology really can bring those costs down and bring the quality of services up significantly. But yes, people will tire of it, and yes, people will particularly tire of it if their living standards are stagnant, if they're having to change without getting any real benefit from things. I tend to think that we may be moving towards a period in which the disruption is a bit more manageable or a bit more controllable, partly because the technology itself is getting a bit better at helping you adapt to change. I certainly find that with my television, that I've got better at using it. It's taken 3 years now, but I'm...
The gentleman in the front.
Thank you. We've mentioned companies, we've mentioned organisations, but what we haven't talked about is nations or governments. And so, or collections of nations. I mean, you touched on the European Union as an example. But is there something disruptive that nations, governments, or collections of nations could embrace and actually lead rather than leaving it to other outfits, companies to be global and everything else, that would drive this better and easier for people and the world?
The problem with countries and collections of countries is that there's a sort of asymmetry between democracy on the one hand, and speed of decision-making on the other hand. So when you hand over decisions, as we often have to do because of globalization, to the European Union or to the United Nations, you tend to delegitimize them in terms of democracy. And so you have democracy is slow. It's hard, and deliberation and consensus forming is very, very slow, and the modern economy demands speed of action. Speed of action tends to create centralization, and that centralization tends to create a lot of resentment. So I think it's very hard to collectivize decision-making and still to preserve democratic legitimacy, and we've seen some extraordinary tests of democratic legitimacy provided by the European Union in recent years. With the last election, I think you had the National Front got 25% of the votes. Farage here, got massive amounts of votes outside London. And the European Union continued just as always. It hasn't changed in response to that. There's a real tension there. And I think that one solution, which I found quite attractive, I don't know if you've ever had anything to do with the United Nations, but it's an extraordinary institution. I mean, extraordinary. It's like a sort of sect. It doesn't seem to relate to the rest of the world. It's obsessed by process. It's obsessed by protocol. It's a group of people who constantly talk to each other but don't reflect the rest of the world. And one idea I found very attractive is the idea of having elected mayors forming some sort of global collectivity or meeting at least once or twice a year where all the mayors from all the major cities in the world actually go together and talk about things, partly because, you could then bring together mayors who are quite responsive to local politics to meet together, to discuss ideas, exchange notions, to act as some sort of parliament of mayors, at least, which will try and create some sort of global institution which is rooted in locality. But at the moment, this notion that we have these civil servants, diplomats, bureaucrats who meet together in the United Nations, I think does not solve this problem. But it's an incredibly difficult problem to solve.
Thank you very much. I wonder if I could draw you out a little to talk to the question of technological unemployment. And particularly, I mean, I live in the United States where we have an election brewing. And, of course, there's a brewed election here. And the extent to which that fundamental question is simply not, finding any access point into public discourse and the risk implications as one looks over time. Would you care to comment?
Whereabouts in America do you live?
Well, I work in Washington.
D.C.
Yeah.
I think it's the biggest problem that we confront at the moment, and the fact that actually this election in Britain has been an absurdity and a joke. I mean, it's just embarrassing because basically any subject of any importance has been studiously avoided foreign policy, technological unemployment, everything. In America, you have such long elections that at some point they probably have to talk about it. If you have an election that lasts 18 months, you almost by accident hit on at one of those days something that matters. But technological unemployment is the biggest problem. And I tried to talk a little bit about what's happening. If you look at, you know, U.S. Steel employing more people than the Army and Navy together, and that's the driver of the economy in that day. In the age of silicon, the drivers of the economy employ very, very few people. And what's more, not only do they employ very few people in terms of numbers, but they want their employment contract to be as light as possible. They don't want to take the risk of having people around that they can't get rid of. They want to be asset light and they want to be people light. And I think we do have a period in which machines are taking over very, very quickly. They're taking over a lot of jobs, and they're particularly taking over the jobs of the educated middle classes. So a lot of people who've thought that they were protected from competition or protected from the automation of their work are going to find that that's not the case in the next few years. I talked to a very significant figure in the technology industry who said that basically we would have another 15 years of abundance, in the sense that technology would make a lot of stuff abundant that had been rare in the past: information, videos, films, entertainment, an incredible explosion of abundance. He said abundance for 15 years followed by redundancy, by which he meant human beings would be redundant. That there's nothing, there's no value that they can add after, because machines are going to become so much more powerful, so much more quickly, and so much more capable of creating stuff and ideas and books and symphonies and articles in The Economist or whatever, that we basically won't have a job. There will be no role for us, and they will treat us, to the extent that machines can do this, with as sort of, you know, with contempt, as irrelevances, as sort of annoyances that can be, have to be squeezed out of the system. And I said, well, this is a rather extreme view of the world. He said, well, what people like you don't understand, I mean, but people like me who are not rooted in the technology industry, is just how fast this revolution is and how much pace it is gathering. So it's getting faster and faster all the time. So the area that human beings can add value to is shrinking and being challenged all the time. So I think that this question of technological unemployment or technological redundancy is absolutely at the centre of politics for the next 10, 15, 20 years, and you know, perhaps one day even the politicians might address it.
But we're just not quite ready to talk about it yet.
We're not ready to talk about anything.
So last question from the lady.
Thank you. Another American, and just an aside about the UN, there is a U.S. Conference of Mayors that does share ideas and meet every year and do all that sort of thing. The question I have for you is, I'm showing my own prejudice, how would you disrupt what I see as a social complacency amongst individuals that they think following Oprah on Twitter for 15 seconds and holding a sign, "Free Our Girls," with regard to Africa, or the George Clooney's of, you know, "I Am Charlie"? How would you disrupt people's complacency to encourage them to actually engage more, spend hours volunteering, giving significant contributions to a cause and association? How would you disrupt complacency as I see it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I remember going to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and it's a fantastic institution in which you have people actually talking. I mean, I lived in Washington for 15 years, and Washington politics, national politics, is increasingly dead. I mean, it's just polarized. It's a matter of shallow gestures. It doesn't work. People don't discuss serious things. But if you go to if you listen to Congress, it's brain dead. It's tedious. If you listen to the Conference of Mayors, these are people grappling with real problems in a post practical, non ideological way. So there is a lot of excitement going on in politics. It's just not happening on the national level, let alone on the international level. It's happening in areas where it's much closer to what people are doing. On the issue of the Twitter and the Free Our Girls and all of this thing, Malcolm Gladwell, you know, talks about slacktivism, and that's exactly what it is. You know, you press the button and you've solved your conscience, and that's wonderful, and you've solved the problem. But I do think that actually there is a lot of volunteering, particularly in America, but also everywhere. There's a lot of real commitment by ordinary people to solving problems, to working. So there is complacency in the Clooney world and the rest of it. But I think amongst ordinary people, I think there's an amazing amount of activism and help. And people talk about the cognitive surplus, that people have time and energy to talk and solve problems. I think quite often we need to be a little bit more imaginative in the way that we solve these problems. One idea that I keep coming back to is the idea that education, we think of education as something where older people teach younger people things. And I think that we need to reverse that quite often, that particularly with the internet, which is changing all the time, we need younger people teaching older people what's going on. I think it's a terribly difficult world if you're over 60 or 70 or 80 with all this constant change and constant disruption. And there is a role for younger people to start teaching us, people like me, how to use these machines.
Very interesting. I think we've covered the very essence of humanity, actually, in this conversation, rather than just the sort of digital disruption that's afoot. I would definitely recommend Adrian's book. It's a very humorous read, as well as a very big picture about what this age of disruption really looks like. Thank you for coming along. It's been a very enjoyable conversation for me, and hopefully for you too. An excellent set of questions from our audience. So finally, please join me once again in thanking our terrific speaker, Adrian Waters.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.